This is Interviews, a podcast from the National Academy of Sciences that provides first-person accounts of the lives and work of Academy members. In this series of one-on-one conversations, scientists talk about what inspired them to pursue the careers they chose and describe some of the most fascinating aspects of their research. For Caroline Harwood, science means solving real problems for real people. That single simple principle has driven the microbiologist to explore some pretty complicated territory. Through her research, scientists now know more about how bacteria encase themselves in antibiotic-resistant slime, survive in seemingly toxic environments, and break down pollutants in the Earth's soil. Her current work on photosynthetic bacteria may even create a pollution-free source of hydrogen, a potential fuel for future technology. Harwood didn't come by her commitment to practical science easily. It grew from her daughter's battle with cystic fibrosis, a deadly genetic disease. People with cystic fibrosis produce abnormal mucus that impairs their breathing and digestion and leaves them vulnerable to pathogens. One of these is the bacterium Pseudomonas aeruginosa, which can also infect burn victims and others with compromised immune systems. When Harwood began working on Pseudomonas as a postdoctoral researcher, she admits she wasn't thinking about the bacterium's association with disease. But she credits her daughter's illness with redirecting her science, making it as much about helping others as it is about gaining knowledge for its own sake. Harwood is the Gerald and Lynn Grinstein Endowed Professor in Microbiology at the University of Washington and was elected to the National Academy of Sciences in 2009.
My name's Carrie Harwood. I'm a microbiologist, and I was elected to the National Academy on April 28th of 2009, which is actually also my birthday.
Oh.
So when I got the call from the National Academy, I thought it was my mother calling me to wish me happy birthday.
Well, that's a nice present.
Yes, it was great.
Where did you grow up?
I grew up in Corning, New York, in upstate New York, sort of near Ithaca. My father worked for the Corning Glass Works. He was a businessman, and so this was a small company town, about 18,000 population, and we lived sort of out in the country, and there's lots of woods around our house. There were lots of fossils. And there was a pond nearby that had a lot of tadpoles and salamanders in it. And those were sorts of things that I found really interesting and fun. We could go out just anywhere, really, and the dogs ran all around. And, yeah, it was fun to go in the woods and make trails. And this pond was sort of the center of the neighborhood activity because we could go, we went swimming in it in the summer and we went skating on it in the winter. So it was sort of an idyllic existence. And my parents were from Boston, so we also spent a lot of time around the Boston area and around Cape Cod in the summers. So I had sort of I had exposure to the ocean and marine life, which I also really loved, especially horseshoe crabs and scallops and catching baby eels, swimming at night and diving into the water and luminescence would light up all around your body, and lightning bugs, I remember, I really liked. So I think these are the things that got me interested in the nap. Natural world, or I naturally was interested in the world around me, and that gradually drew me into being more and more interested in science.
Were you a tomboy?
Yeah, I was a tomboy. Actually, I wished I was a boy for a long time, but then I decided that was, you know, I had to accept the fact that I was a girl.
Why did you wish you were a boy?
Because boys could do a lot of things I didn't think I'd ever be able to do.
What kinds of things did you think you might want to do?
Well, I didn't, you know, there weren't really any women who were scientists that I knew of. it just seemed like it was sort of a man's world, and men had a lot more opportunities than women did, and so that's why I kind of wished I weren't a girl for a long time. But I got over that. I was fortunate because I think because I lived in such a small town, my parents sent me to away to school, to a boarding school outside of Boston, and it was an all-girls school. And then once I went there, I felt a lot more empowered that I'd be able to do anything I wanted to do, essentially. Mm-hmm. That was just a great experience for me. I'll never forget the day my grandmother dropped me off. I was 14 and it was pouring rain. And she just dropped me off and said, "Okay, Carrie, I'll see you later." So I was scared to death. But once I started taking classes, I just felt like I could breathe. And it was just really intellectually stimulating. And everyone else at the school was really pretty smart and really pretty motivated. And so we just worked together in small classes, and I thought every single one was really interesting, except for French, which I didn't like. But the teachers were terrific, and I felt like everything I know about the world, other than science, I learned at this school. And I had good science education, but that wasn't the part of it I value the most. I value the most, like, sort of the history and the training and learning how to write well and how to think critically. And we just felt like we could do anything. And it was sort of pre-women's movement. So we didn't really talk about the fact that we were women in a men's world. We just knew that we'd all go to good schools and go on to do our best to sort of make the world better. It was an idealistic time. It was in the late 60s during the Vietnam War. So we were planning on doing something useful, I think, all of us.
So then you went to college.
Yeah.
Where did you go?
I went to Colby College in Waterville, Maine, which was fine. It was a big disappointment to me that I didn't get into the schools I wanted to go to.
Which were?
Well, I really wanted to go to Stanford, and I didn't get in. But I went to Colby. It was okay. It wasn't really what I wanted. But I did major in biology, and gradually I made my way to graduate school. And once I got going in grad school, I wasn't really a particularly good student in college, so I didn't have many options for where I could go to school. But eventually I made my way to the University of Massachusetts at Amherst. First I actually went to Boston University for a master's. And then I worked in the laboratory of Lynn Margulis, who's actually an NAS member now. And when I was in her lab, I saw an advertisement to take this summer course at the Marine Biological Laboratory in Woods Hole. And it was in microbial diversity. And I'd never taken microbiology. And in Lynn Margulis's lab, she worked on protozoa, which weren't bacteria. But I applied for this course, and I got in. And I went down to Woods Hole for, I think it were 10 weeks in the summer. And it was great. I loved it. And I learned how to isolate all different kinds of bacteria. And that's when I decided, I just fell in love with bacteria. And I came back from that, and then I knew exactly what I wanted to do. By that time, I was maybe about 25 or so. And so once I'd sort of settled on a discipline, then I switched and I went to the University of Massachusetts at Amherst. And then from then on, I was like on my way for doing serious bacteriology.
What was it about the bacteria that drew you in?
That drew me in. Because there's just so many different kinds of them. And it's pretty easy to bring bacteria into captivity, from mud into captivity in the lab. there's all kinds of little tricks you can use to get different kinds. Like you can get ones that use light for energy, but only a particular wavelength of light. You can get ones that are really long and skinny, and so you only get those because they can swim through agar better than other ones. You can get ones that grow on toluene, which is a solvent. So you can get, there's lots of different kinds of bacteria that can do things that humans can't do. And that's what or that higher organisms, eukaryotic organisms, can't do. So I was drawn to bacteria because my theme was always to be interested in things bacteria do that we can't.
So what happened next?
Yeah, so next I went to, so then after I took this course at Woods Hole, then I went to University of Massachusetts and got my PhD, and then I went to Yale for a postdoc. When I went to Yale, it so happened that I wanted to work on a group of organisms called Pseudomonas. So I needed to look around for some funding for my postdoc. So I wrote an application for postdoctoral fellowship to the Cystic Fibrosis Foundation. So cystic fibrosis is a disease that affects the epithelial. It's a genetic disease. It's the most common lethal genetic disease among Caucasians. And it's just one little mutation that causes mucus on epithelial cells to get too thick. And the consequence of that is that people with cystic fibrosis get lung infections. And they usually get an infection with a specific kind of bacterium called Pseudomonas. So I wrote a fellowship to work on the basic biology of Pseudomonas to the Cystic Fibrosis Foundation. I wasn't really, to be honest, paying all that much attention to the association with cystic fibrosis. But I finished my postdoc, and then I got married, and I moved to Cornell. My husband was an assistant professor at Cornell. And then we had a child, and it turned out that our child has cystic fibrosis. She was born, and something wasn't right with her from the second she was born. She's just born in this little tiny hospital in Ithaca. So they rushed her to Elmira, where they actually had a children's ICU unit for babies. And then they figured out that she had a blocked intestine, which is a complication that a few percentage of babies with cystic fibrosis are born with. So we knew right away when she's 2 days old that she had cystic fibrosis. Wow. And so that has had a big influence on both Pete and me as people and on our science, a big influence. After Barbara was born, we realized she was not going to get kind of medical care she needed from the location in which we were living, which was very isolated geographically, actually, from big medical centers, where you have to be to get the kind of care you need for a disease as complicated, as serious as cystic fibrosis. Because of that, we moved to, we had an opportunity to move to the University of Iowa, in Iowa City, Iowa, which actually has one of the very best cystic fibrosis clinics in the country, in the world. And it was kind of a fortunate thing scientifically for me too, because they offered me a job as an assistant professor, which I was not going to be offered at Cornell. Well, actually, Cornell did offer me a job as an assistant professor, but not until after I told them I was leaving to go to the University of Iowa, which is very typical. So we did move to the University of Iowa, and we lived there for 16 years, and we had another child, Ted, who's fine. And Barbara got as good a care as she could have. And we both continued to work on Pseudomonas and cystic fibrosis, and sort of the problems related to lung infections that occur with cystic fibrosis patients. Pete, my husband, especially did a lot of work on this. I did less work than he did. And the University of Iowa, is really a good place for me because we were in the medical school, but it was a nurturing medical school. And I could have a research program that was about maybe 6 people or so. I had 2 grants, one on my Pseudomonas work and one on my other work, which ended up being the really important work I did, which was on how benzene rings get biodegraded when there's no oxygen around. So I had those 2 projects and worked away at them. It was a very good place for us to be. It was in the Midwest, and everyone had families, and so it was okay to leave at 4:30 in the afternoon to go take care of your family. there wasn't any stigma attached to that whatsoever.
That sounds unusual.
Yeah. So it was, it was great. But Barbara did pretty well, but she was always really pretty sick with CF too, so she had to go in and out of the hospital a lot. By the time she got into high school, she was really starting to go downhill, and the only way she would survive is if she had a lung transplant. And not very many places in the country do lung transplants still, and the University of Iowa did not do them at that time. So we had an opportunity to move to the University of Washington in 2005, and we did move for lots of different reasons. But a big one was because Barbara would be able to possibly get a lung transplant from the University of Washington Medical Center, which has a very good team. And in 2007, she did have a lung transplant, and she's here with us today.
Wow.
And so it's been a miracle. It's been a journey.
And she's doing well.
She's doing well, yeah. Wow. Well, she's 24. She's still going to the University of Washington. She had to take a few years. She was so sick that she couldn't really do anything but lie in bed with oxygen on. But now she's all buzzing around. And she'll be the first person to graduate with a major in disability studies from the University of Washington. It's a new major, which she is spearheading.
That's amazing. So, I mean, I'm sure this propelled your research all this time.
It did.
So, I mean, how was it working on Pseudomonas when Barbara had CF?
Sometimes it was really, really hard for me. It wasn't hard when I was in the lab, but it was exceptionally hard to go to meetings for me when CF was being discussed, and to go to CF meetings, because a lot of scientists just didn't really work on it, but they didn't really understand what a terrible disease it was. And so I always sort of like to hang out with the CF clinicians, because they really understood. So sometimes it was really hard sometimes, but... And in my other research, which is also kind of practically oriented for this biodegradation of pollutants aspect, I think what Barbara having CF made me realize is that you can do really good basic science and it can be of practical value too. And it's been really helpful for me to keep in mind that science is for solving problems that are real problems for real people and real problems in society. And what we do is sometimes so far from that because, you know, we're manipulating one amino acid and one protein and seeing what happens. But me remembering what our ultimate goal is has really helped me be a better researcher. I always want to do something that's really going to be of value to society and help people, even if it's something that I can only see happening when I hand off my research to someone who's better at doing the development, an engineer or a biotech company or something. I still want to get it to the point where it could be developed into something valuable. That's a very important overall principle for me.
And so tell me what work you've done in those areas.
Okay, well, one thing I've done, I guess I would say I've done three things. In the cystic fibrosis area, which is related to my work on Pseudomonas, I've worked on understanding why it is that Pseudomonas is so good at growing together in slimy clumps. These little tiny individual cells of Pseudomonas can just swim around by themselves. But when they get into the CF lung or they get into other situations where surfaces are available, they like to settle on the surfaces and grow together as a community, and then they encase themselves in a slimy kind of material, and those are called biofilms. Like the inside of a shower curtain where it's all slimy, that's a biofilm. That's all bacteria growing encased in this slime. So it's the biofilm mode of growth that is such a problem in cystic fibrosis lungs, and it's a problem in any kind of chronic infection, especially any kind of infection where people have indwelling medical devices, like catheters get infected a lot. Urinary catheters, those are bacterial biofilms that are causing the infection, and they're very, very resistant to antibiotic treatment because the cells are all clumped together and it's hard for the antibiotics to get into the cells, and usually the cells aren't growing very fast either. So my contribution there, of which I was just one of many, was to understand that the bacteria somehow know they're on a surface, and when they know that, they produce this little sort of intracellular hormone. It's called cyclic IgMP. And this little intracellular hormone tells them to make the globby thing on the outside of the cells, the extracellular matrix that is the biofilm. So now we understand that this one little molecule, cyclic IgMP, is sort of the key to everything. When they have a lot of it inside them, they make a lot of biofilm. When they hardly have any inside them, they make a little biofilm, a little bit of biofilm or no biofilm. So that is a potential target for antibiofilm therapy to try to interfere with cyclic IgMP metabolism in cells. So that's one thing I've done in that area. I've also worked a lot on biodegradation of pollutants, and I have figured out some biochemical pathways for how bacteria degrade pollutants. And I've also done work to show that when there are pollutants in the environment, bacteria can sense that they're there and they can swim over to them, because the pollutants are food for the bacteria. So they'll swim over to them by a process called chemotaxis, and that is now actually known from other work that engineers have done to enhance biodegradation, that ability to sense and swim towards them, well, because they get over there, enhances the ability of the cells to break down the pollutants.
So what might be one pollutant that you can target in this way?
Well, a group of pollutants of concern to the Environmental Protection Agency is called BTEX, benzene, toluene, ethyl, benzene, and xylene. And those compounds are found in gasoline, quite an alarmingly large number of gas stations are leaking gasoline from those big tanks where gasoline is stored. So a lot of this kind of pollutant gets into the environment, and it does, these pollutants do get degraded by bacteria that are in the soil. And now we understand how they are degraded, partly because of work I've done. And we have the opportunity to enhance their ability to degrade the pollutant by adding certain nutrients to soil, etc.
Because they can't quite keep up with...
yeah. Well, sometimes, yeah, so things so in theory they can degrade the pollutants, but things happen, like they still need other nutrients to be able to grow well, like they need a little bit of nitrogen and they need some phosphate and maybe a little bit of sulfur. So if those things just don't happen to be in the soil, then their ability to degrade things slows down and their ability to grow slows down.
And what's the third thing?
The third thing is what I'm really excited about right now, is I work on bioenergy production by a photosynthetic bacterium, and I specifically work on hydrogen gas production. So the kind of bacteria that we work with is photosynthetic. It gets all its energy from light, and it can be manipulated in the laboratory to produce large amounts of hydrogen gas, which is a potential biofuel for the future. Well, you might have heard about hydrogen cars. The way those cars run is hydrogen gas gets fed into a hydrogen fuel cell, and the hydrogen fuel cell converts the hydrogen gas to electricity, and the electricity is used to drive the car, and the combustion product is water. So there's no carbon dioxide emissions when hydrogen is used as a fuel, and it's completely non-polluting. So it would probably be a while before we'd all be driving hydrogen cars in the U.S., but it's definitely a potential fuel source that's being worked on pretty intensively by the Department of Energy, for example. What I'm interested in doing is getting our bacteria to degrade the environmental pollutants and funnel some of the electrons that are on those pollutants into the enzyme that's used to make hydrogen gas.
So then looking to the future, where would you like to see this go for each of your projects?
Well, I'd like to see cystic fibrosis cured, actually.
Yeah.
And a way to treat cystic fibrosis infections, but I think the better thing to do would be to cure the basic defect in cystic fibrosis, which actually quite a bit of progress is being made on by other scientists. I think we've made a lot of good progress on pollution in this country, and actually companies don't pollute nearly as much as they used to. So we understand how bacteria can degrade pollutants pretty well now, and how to manipulate them to do so. But fortunately, we don't need to use bioremediation as much as we thought we would have to in the past, because federal regulations and just good citizenship on the part of corporate America has dealt a lot with this problem, media problem of pollution. And our energy problem is huge, and our CO2 emissions problem is huge. And if I could just make one little contribution to our energy solution, which I think will be multifactorial, our problem of getting off our addiction to fossil fuels, then I'd be really proud.
What advice would you give to a young person interested in a career in science?
I would say you should just go along, and if you want to be a scientist, you know, just don't overthink the problem. I talk to a lot of women when I go around and give seminars, young women, and they're like, worried about this and worried about that. You know, they're legitimate concerns. You know, when am I going to have a family? How could I possibly have a family and, you know, work 80 hours a week, etc. And I felt that way too. But a friend of mine just said, just set yourself on a path and just do the best you can and see where you end up. I mean, you shouldn't decide you're not going to do something because you think maybe you can't do it. Just give it a try and see how it works out for you is what my advice would be.
Since 1863, the nation's top scientists have been honored with membership in the National Academy of Sciences. Today, there are more than 2,500 in the NAS membership, of whom approximately 200 have won Nobel Prizes. We hope you have enjoyed this episode of Interviews and invite you to join us again for another inspiring conversation.